and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the Senate Intelligence Committee has invited Julian Assange to meet with its professional staff members behind closed doors to discuss alleged Russian interference in the 2016 election. The formal invitation was signed by both committee chairman Richard Burr and vice chairman Mark Warner. There's no indication that the committee will provide Assange with any guarantees for his safety if he chooses to accept the invitation. Next, there are several new developments in Russiagate. It's day seven of the Paul Manafort trial. Rudy Giuliani and Trump's personal lawyer, Jay Sekulow, just announced that they will not have Donald Trump sit for an interview with Robert Mueller. And the Trump administration announced new sanctions against Russia based on a finding that the Russian government is, in fact, responsible for the poisonings of defecting double agent Skripal. Then the Chinese Commerce Ministry slapped another 25% tariff on $16 billion of U.S. goods, including automobiles and motorcycles. This comes in the wake of the U.S. Trade Representative's decision to place 25% tariffs on $16 billion of Chinese goods. And then the European Union is sending a message to Iran. That message is that the Europeans are serious about salvaging the Iran nuclear deal. An aide to the EU's foreign policy chief said yesterday that European firms that stop doing business with Iran will in turn be sanctioned by the EU. And finally, National Security Advisor John Bolton said yesterday that the administration is, quote, still waiting, unquote, for North Korea to begin the denuclearization process. He added that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wants a second summit with President Trump, but that is unlikely, absent real progress on the North Korean weapons and nuclear programs. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Senate Intelligence Committee has invited Julian Assange to meet with its professional staff members behind closed doors to discuss alleged Russian interference in the 2016 election. The formal invitation was signed by both committee chairman Richard Burr, a Republican of North Carolina, and vice chairman Mark Warner, a Democrat of Virginia. There's no indication that the committee will provide Assange with any guarantees for his safety if he chooses to accept it. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's the managing editor for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. Kevin, good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin, WikiLeaks tweeted essentially what I just read, that they had received this invitation. It was hand-delivered by somebody from the American Embassy in London to the Ecuadorian Embassy in London, and that's it. What do you make of this? Do you think that this is a positive development, or is this a setup?
So it's really difficult to tell, but I think we have to go off of what we know about the people who are part of this intelligence committee as far as whether they genuinely want to know the truth from Julian Assange. And I would say that because you have Mark Warner as a vice chairman, because you have Joe Manchin and Dianne Feinstein, who are part of the committee as well. These are three individuals who just signed a letter pressuring Ecuador to revoke the asylum for Julian Assange. And so I think when you consider that alongside the fact that, for the most part, the political class has accepted the CIA narrative around WikiLeaks fully, as well as parts of the establishment media like MSNBC and CNN, have fully adopted everything that Mike Pompeo has to say about WikiLeaks, then you have to be very skeptical about what is going on. But I do note that, you know, Assange, WikiLeaks, the tweet that was sent out does mention that the lawyers are considering it if, you know, there is a potential that they can give the sort of testimony they want to give under the kinds of parameters. I mean, for a very small scope of information, they would be willing to talk to senators, it seems like.
You know, I wonder, too, if we can make or if we can draw a parallel between this invitation and the subpoena that was issued to Oliver North in the 1980s to testify in the Iran-Contra affair. North agreed to testify. I remember his attorney was Brandon Sullivan, and Sullivan negotiated a deal whereby North would have immunity. And so what North did, and it was really a brilliant stroke, he confessed to everything. He told the truth. He told the entire story. And so when the hearings were done and he was charged with multiple felonies by the Justice Department, he was able to get those charges dismissed with prejudice because he had the congressional immunity. And so nothing that he said was admissible. I wonder if this is something that Julian and his legal team can take advantage of as well. Maybe the Intelligence Committee really, really wants to know what Julian knows about Russia and the election. And I wonder if they're willing to give him some immunity, limited or otherwise, to hear what he has to say.
That's not a bad scenario to contemplate. And I could see where they might be willing to bargain. Can you guarantee that you're going to allow me to have this asylum? I know that between Ecuador and the United States, there's been pressure. I know that you've been talking to the United Kingdom all this time. Maybe, in fact, he recognizes the precarious nature of his situation within the embassy. I know he doesn't want to stay there forever. So maybe he could say, why don't you allow me to make a transition onto UK soil? I'm going to be safe, guarantee that the United Kingdom is not going to arrest me and press charges, and that I'm going to be able to begin to take steps to move on with my life. And in return, I'll offer you some of what I know about what happened. And I will say, just for the record, that based on public statements that Assange has made, it's difficult to know exactly what WikiLeaks knows. And I think publicly we never will know. But what's interesting is that what the intelligence community has claimed versus what WikiLeaks says, in some ways have actually kind of matched up without people actually paying any attention, you know, pointing out that I believe in a year or two ago, Julian was insistent that as far as the timeline of events that are important to this investigation, nobody has really nailed down the timeline of when documents leave WikiLeaks as far as official reports from the Intelligence Committee, and then hasn't been able to separate that from the actions of this Guccifer 2.0 character. So that's, I think that's what's important about this letter to Julian Assange. It's an admission, I think, that in the narrative that people have been fed and have fully adopted, they actually haven't really gotten the facts, and that we really should continue to be asking questions rather than have it settled that at some point. Because what it is in the media and what it is as far as U.S. politicians, it's accepted that someone associated or with some loose ties to Russia passed this information on to Julian Assange, and then the WikiLeaks organization had these emails. And then at some point, Roger Stone is talking to Julian Assange, and Donald Trump Jr. is sending messages. There's direct messages on Twitter going back and forth between the Trump campaign. And then all of a sudden, these emails are dumped, and oh, wow, they coincide with the Access Hollywood tape. Well, I don't know if it's as clean as people have been selling it, as Rachel Maddow has been selling it to people. And so I think that's kind of a remarkable aspect to me of this Intelligence Committee request, is that, you know, they themselves probably don't have the timeline nailed down.
You know, I think that's probably it. I wonder, again, if the committee really doesn't know as much as we think it knows and wants to know badly enough that they're willing to offer some sort of a quid pro quo. I wonder if this is something that might break the logjam rather than being a trick or a trap or an empty gesture even.
Yeah, these are really interesting issues to ponder. And of course, it's speculation, and we don't
all
know.
All of it is speculation.
We don't know. Kevin Gostal is our guest. Kevin, you know, there's another element. If Julian Assange comes out of that embassy and is taken into custody by the Brits and then sent to the United States for, you know, there's a secret grand jury that's going to indict him, when you think about what a Julian Assange trial might look like in the United States, it might not be something that the powers that be actually want. Because, you know, WikiLeaks has so much information on so much of what the U.S. government has done. And potentially, a Julian Assange trial could be a huge embarrassment for the same powers in the United States that say they want to make an example out of him. Anyway, what's your thought about that?
any sort of trial against Julian Assange in the U.S. would make a mockery of the First Amendment, first of all. I mean, let's be very clear that even journalists within the New York Times and some of these press freedom organizations that have been really reluctant to support WikiLeaks, at no matter what, regardless of their views about how the organization operates, they've been very clear that it would be violating the First Amendment to put a publisher on trial for the publication of these documents. So then you have to have clear clear evidence that they violated some kind of other law that has nothing to do with the First Amendment. So maybe it's a computer misuse law, or maybe it's something else of that nature. Yeah. You can't charge him as a traitor. He's not from the United States, so he has no like allegiance to the U.S. So any sort of laws on the books as far as like the Espionage Act go wouldn't apply. I find it very odd that they would think they could charge him when he's not a U.S. citizen. And so that to me would be alarming, that they could bring a publisher of WikiLeaks here who's you know, he's an Australian, and charge him. But, you know, beyond that, I think there would be this whole show going on, and I think Julian would be very good at playing it and playing against the way the United States government is such a vast superpower, and playing that up as WikiLeaks does in all of its releases and talking about the power that the United States has. And that probably would be a nightmare for Democrats and Republicans in Washington.
But I'll tell you what the danger is for Julian, and it comes out of my case. This was the most important thing that came out of my case, and that was Judge Leanne Brinkema redefined the Espionage Act, and she did it very simply. She said that the Espionage Act says that a person shall be guilty of espionage if they provide national defense information to any person not entitled to receive it, period. And my attorney said, are you saying, Your Honor, that a person can accidentally commit espionage? And she said, yes, and can be prosecuted for it. So even though Julian's not an American citizen, they can charge him with espionage because he's a publisher and because he published the WikiLeaks information, which they consider to be national defense information.
Well, John, let me throw it back to you. Given what Kevin is saying, that a trial of a media publisher, and yes, that's what WikiLeaks
terrible
is.
Terrible precedent.
Even if the New York Times editorial board and publisher won't stand up for Julian, even though they use his material, same with the Washington Post, same with the CNN, same yes, with Los Angeles Times. The management's not doing anything, but there are a lot of reporters who are going to think like, hey, really? You're going to send this guy to prison, a publisher of a media outlet? What do you think about that? That this would be like the First Amendment trial of the century?
It truly would. And this is where we get to see what a lot of different people are made of, because this is one of those trials that's going to be appealed and appealed and appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court. Regardless of what happens, even if Julian is acquitted, there are going to be issues for appeal that the Justice Department is going to want to address all the way up to the Supreme Court. I agree with you. I think this would be such an incredibly dangerous development if Julian were to be charged
dangerous,
with a crime.
Dangerous for the powers that be.
Dangerous for the Constitution, for our constitutional rights to freedom of speech and freedom of the press, because I frankly don't trust the courts, and I don't trust American juries.
I can't understand how you, John Kiriakou, came to the conclusion that you don't trust the courts.
Well, we can talk about that
Kevin
on another
Gostella,
show.
We have 30 seconds. Go ahead.
No, I think these are all very important points. And the biggest takeaway for me here is that it really seems like the Senate wants something out of Julian Assange, because they themselves, I think that we've hit on it, the fact that they don't really have this timeline nailed down, and all along the U.S. intelligence hasn't really given us any specific dates and times for when certain information, you know, might have been transmitted and transferred, and it's been really hard. But that hasn't mattered to people like Rachel Maddow, who just talk loosely and don't care about, you know, whether there's proof of allegations.
So true. Rachel Maddow's the worst. We were joined from Chicago by our friend Kevin Gostella. He's the managing editor for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Hey, John, there's a bunch of new developments in the Russiagate. It's day seven of the Manafort trial. Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump's personal lawyer just announced that they will not sit for an interview, have Donald Trump sit for an interview with Robert Mueller. And just as we began recording, the Trump administration announced new sanctions against Russia based on a finding that the Russian government, in fact, is responsible for the poisonings of the British defecting double agent Skripal and his daughter. A lot going on today.
Big news on the Russia front today. We should take these one at a time because they're connected but separate at the same time. The Manafort trial keeps plugging along with revelation after revelation. I have to say, I knew Rick Gates was going to be exciting up on the stand. I had no idea it was going to be this exciting. The man has confessed on the stand under oath to any number of felonies that no one knew anything about, in addition to cheating on his wife and to stealing money from the Trump inaugural committee. I don't think anybody saw that coming.
Yeah, the presidential inaugural committee stole money from that. He also stole money from Paul Manafort.
Yeah, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, like a lot of money. And then it turned out, Walter, as we mentioned yesterday, and this the media has obscured this, I think.
I agree.
That the testimony from Rick Gates was that when they, meaning Gates and Manafort, were working as lobbyists for Yanukovych's government, the toppled government in Ukraine, which was toppled in 2014, they were doing it on behalf of trying to bring Yanukovych and Ukraine's government into the European Union. They even had an operation crafted by Manafort called Engage Ukraine. In other words, the Russians would perceive Paul Manafort and Gates's role in Ukraine as not something like a proxy from the Kremlin, but just the opposite. They were doing something the Russians feared, bring Ukraine into the Western orbit.
Yeah, one of the foundational myths of the Russiagate phenomenon in the United States is that the Yanukovych government was nothing more than a puppet of the Russian government or personally of Vladimir Putin. And therefore, anything that was done by the Ukrainian government of Yanukovych or on behalf of the Yanukovych government was therefore something, you know, it might as well have just been done by Vladimir Putin himself. That's not true. That's not an accurate characterization of the Yanukovych government. What Yanukovych wanted to do was balance the relations between these two major powers that they effectively share borders with, right? There's the European Union to the west, and then there's Russia to the east. Yanukovych was more than willing to do business with the European Union. They wouldn't have hatched this plan, right, that Manafort was involved in to bring closer.
Yanukovych actually balked at the EU ultimatum in September, October 2013, which was to have Ukraine enter the EU as part of an association agreement, would be basically imposing austerity on Ukraine. So he said no to that. The protests started. The U.S. said the protests were, you know, a glorious, you know, manifestation of Ukrainian freedom and democracy. The reality is Manafort was working there. And John, there were other lobbyists, other Washington lobbyists, connected people, maybe even Tony Podesta working in Ukraine too. But their goal was to bring Yanukovych into the EU. And Yanukovych may very well have been willing to come into the EU, but with a better deal.
Right, with a better deal. To the first point that you made, I think that we've just seen the tip of the iceberg here in terms of the number of very big Washington names that are going to be implicated in this whole scandal, whether it's because of the money, whether it's because of the relationship with Ukraine, or whether it's a connection with some other element that hasn't been reported in the past. Perhaps they didn't register as a foreign agent. I think that there's going to be a lot more of this coming out.
Well, we only have 5 minutes for this segment, so let's go on to some of the other breaking news. John, Giuliani and Trump's personal lawyer said, guess what? No, Trump's not going to sit for an interview with Robert Mueller.
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, that's what a lot of people think they said. You're talking about both Rudy Giuliani and Jay Sekulow. Sekulow has been a lot more conservative on this issue. He doesn't want Trump to testify at all. He doesn't want Trump to sit and talk to Robert Mueller at all. And frankly, I think the president would be very foolish to sit and talk to the special counsel, because he has nothing to gain.
There's nothing there for him.
Zero. Nothing to gain and everything to lose, because When you're interviewed in a situation like this, the prosecution always knows the answers to the questions before they ask the questions. And what they're trying to do is to trip you up and get you to say something that you shouldn't say, or perhaps your memory is foggy and you're not remembering things.
Completely unlike Donald Trump,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
That's not in his personality
at all. And also, Walter, we know, I mean, you know, outside of the fact that some liberals have now decided that truth, justice, and the American way is embodied in the FBI, for all the years that I've been an anti-war activist, we always told people if the FBI comes and says even that they want to be friends with you and talk to you, don't talk to the FBI because you can't gain anything from talking to them.
Right. Donald Trump appears to have so much confidence in his own rhetorical and argumentative abilities that he thinks, this is according to some reports in the media, I don't know if this is 100% accurate or not, but some people are reporting that he actually thinks that he can convince Mueller that in fact there was nothing there, and through the strength of his presentation could wrap this whole thing up. I mean, that to me shows a fundamental misunderstanding of what the whole Mueller
probe
is.
I mean, Mueller's reputation is on the stake, on the line here. He has to come up with prosecutions. He has to come
up
with guilty
job.
Verdicts.
That's it. That's his job. His job is to find people guilty. You know, I told my own lawyers when I was awaiting trial that I wanted to go to trial. I wanted to talk. I wanted to testify because I said, and these were my exact words, it's so naive, I can't even believe I said it now in retrospect. I said, as soon as I can get in front of a jury and explain to them how ridiculous these charges are, I'm going to win. And one of my lawyers said, you think that this is about justice. This isn't about justice. This is about mitigating damage. And that's what Donald Trump should be thinking about right now, is mitigating damage. And you do that by not speaking to Robert Mueller.
All right. And it looks like his lawyers at least are... If they're not saying don't speak, or he won't sit for the interview, at least they want to redefine the terms of an interview, narrowing the scope, as they say. Walter, we have 2 minutes left. Breaking news, new sanctions on Russia. Again, why would the Russians, in plain view, poison the Skripals with this Novichok, the deadliest agent ever, and wildly, weirdly, they recovered somehow, been whisked away so they can't actually tell the story. But again, are you surprised? New harsh measures from the Trump administration against Russia.
Well, it shows, I mean, this is another myth that this sort of busts, that the Trump administration is like exceptionally soft, quote unquote, on Russia. I mean, they're not there. I mean, there have been probably the most hardline in terms of, like, if you look at the actual policies implemented, the most hardline since the end of the Cold War. You know, so the Trump administration, it actually doesn't surprise me that they impose new sanctions because it's in keeping with a trend.
But it's much, you know, you're right. It's much harsher. The policies of the Trump administration are much harsher than Obama. Obama, for instance, wouldn't sell heavy weapons to Ukraine to be used against pro-Russian forces in the eastern part of the country. Trump did that. He did a lot of other things. But the media says, well, Trump's administration is anti-Russia, but Trump himself is pro-Russia because he still says and did say when he met with Putin that he thought U.S. and Russia should have better relations. But didn't Obama and Bush also said the same thing?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's completely normal for, and I mean, it's not just U.S.-Russia really. I mean, there's plenty of, it's just like a part of diplomacy that when you go into a talk with somebody, you're not necessarily going to say all these negative things, unless it's sort of a setup for something else. But yeah, I mean, so the first round of sanctions that were just announced today will target what they're calling, you know, like highly sensitive national security exports. There's possibly another round that will come in on top of that. And yeah, I think it's partially it is other elements within the administration that are concerned about, you know, Donald Trump's. I think he does actually want to see some improvement in relations, as did, you know, Hillary Clinton, as did Barack Obama, as did George W. Bush. And there are people who want to pursue an even more ultra hardline policy. But it's important to be clear about what we're talking about. We're talking about a hardline policy versus a ultra hardline policy. I mean, there's no like peaceniks in the Trump administration.
Yeah, John, that's completely right. We're out of time. We've been joined here in studio by Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Chinese Commerce Ministry slapped another 25% tariff on $16 billion of U.S. goods, including automobiles and motorcycles, today. This comes in the wake of the U.S. Trade Representative's decision to place 25% tariffs on $16 billion of Chinese goods earlier in the week. We're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She is the author of the new book, The U.S. and China, Asia's New Cold War. Jude, it's always good to have you.
Nice to speak to you.
Jude, it seems like every time we speak with you, it's to talk about tariffs and the new tariffs that the Trump administration has placed on China. I saw a report on CNBC yesterday saying that even in spite of all these tariffs, Chinese exports to the U.S. so far this year are up 13%, and that the Chinese are making more money year over year now than they have at any point in the past. So what exactly is the point of all these tariffs?
Well, I mean, as I think I've said many times, it's not clear these tariffs can work to achieve what Donald Trump wants. Firstly, my understanding of the July export figures for China is that its export figures overall are up, but its exports to the United States are slightly down. So, and similarly on imports. So I think it is leading to some shifts away from trade with the US. But mainly so far it's having an impact on prices in the US. Every day you seem to read an article about lobster fishers or lumber producers, and the latest is liquefied gas producers who are worrying about their exports. I mean, a report in the last day or two said that from the US, lobster exports to China have completely dried up. And this is having a devastating effect on the industry. So inside China is also having some effect on prices, but it's having less effect because less cheap goods are affected. Most of the goods China imports from the US are premium goods anyway. So it has less overall impact.
Yeah, Jude, I was looking at the New York Times about, I don't know, I think it was a front page story about a week ago, 10 days ago. I don't have it right in front of me, but it was above the fold. It was about four column widths wide. It was a great big picture of Xi Jinping. And the whole point of the article was quoting an academic in China who had opened up a criticism of Xi Jinping's policy, and the Times was making a huge, huge story of it. I mean, it was a super long article where they're quoting all of these Chinese people who are in various U.S.-funded and U.S.-sponsored think tanks in Beijing, all of whom say the problem with U.S.-China relations right now is that Xi Jinping was, in essence, too arrogant, talking about China 2025, whereby China would assert a growing sort of leadership in the global economy, that it was it lacked prudence, that his anti-corruption campaign was really just a cover for a return to the ideological purges of the 1960s and 1970s. It had all the feelings, the article had all the feelings of the beginning of a campaign for demonization and ultimately regime change. And then it ended by reminding the audience that June 2019 will be the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square protests and the suppression of those protests, and also how the anniversary or the birthday of Deng Xiaoping could be used for those who are coming from the right to counter Xi Jinping to gather, to mobilize, to galvanize an opposition. And it was kind of brimming with a certain optimism that the U.S. might be able to do what I think it's wanted to do for a long time in China, which is to carry out regime change. Anyway, I don't know if you saw the article or your thoughts about this as a trend, at least in the American political discourse.
Well, I think that's the problem. It's a trend in the American discourse, but it's not really a trend in political developments in China, because if anything, the effects of these trade tariffs and the deterioration in U.S.-China relations has been for a plummeting in regards to the U.S. in China. And Xi Jinping's star is rising quite high as having been seen as being prepared to stand up to strong-arming by the U.S. So how this is viewed in China and how these pundits in the US wish that things were unfolding are two entirely different things, and generally are, partly for propaganda reasons and partly because they believe their own propaganda.
So once these sanctions are in place on both sides for a more extended period of time, and Americans come to realize that it really isn't causing or forcing the Chinese to change any kind of policy, it's only actually hurting American consumers, American farmers and manufacturers, how long does it take before people come to their senses, so to speak?
I don't know, because I don't know what the long-term game plan of Trump and co. are. What I think is most unlikely is there's going to be any settlement this side of the midterm elections, because part of the purpose of these trade sanctions is to present a tough image to the U.S. electorate. It's obviously not as simple as that, and that's not the sole goal. But certainly I think the midterm elections mean there's no short-term resolution. Whether after that, if things go well or badly, might make a difference, but whether if after that sense begins to prevail, certainly in the Chinese framework, they've been quite careful not to do exactly tit for tat. And I mean, partly this is because the trade deficit doesn't allow them to put tariffs on quite such a large proportion of U.S. goods as the U.S. can affect Chinese goods. But partly it is because they've had a more measured response. So I think in response to Trump upping the new tariffs to 25%, the Chinese have only upped them to 14 or 15%. So they're trying to create some wriggle room for Trump to back out. But whether the administration wants to do that or just wants to pursue this through, and I think that partly that will affect what is the kickback effect on the U.S. economy, which is a bit early days to make a judgment of yet. But in summary, no quick fix, but maybe things can move after the midterm elections.
Under pressure from the United States, Russia is being, you know, really pounded, even though Donald Trump said he wanted better relations with Russia. The actual measures of the Trump administration have been very, very harsh. And the trade war animus, hostility directed against the People's Republic of China. The question is whether these coordinated policies by the United States, either by design or just happenstance, do they create like a requisite need by China and Russia to develop, or not develop, they've already developed it, to retain and sustain and make a priority a united front between them?
Well, I think that's the problem for the U.S., that it's creating such a united front. This has been going on for some time, since Obama announced the pivot to Asia, or so-called pivot to Asia. It was really a pivot to China. Relations with Russia also took a dive, particularly obviously after Ukraine, but even before that, then what you've seen happening is closer and closer treaties, coordination, cooperation, trade, close relationships between China and Russia. And this is obviously very important to both, because they have a hugely long shared border. And if they don't have to worry about that, because they have friendly relations along that border, and they're both very large military powers, which together are a very sizable force in the world, then this makes it much more difficult for the US to get leverage in the situation. And there are serious commentators not my political orientation, but of the right, who say that this is a mistake. And that is why there's a serious lobby inside the United States for good relations with Russia. It's not just mad people around Trump, but they have a less progressive purpose, which is to disrupt relations between Russia and China and to offer Russia the alternative of better relations with the West. But so far, that's not the policy that's won out. And it's very difficult to deliver, because you'd have to have a settlement for Crimea, you'd have to fix Syria, and obviously the relations now over Iran deteriorate.
Jude, let me ask you in our last 30 seconds, what do you think about the prospects or the possibility that the Russian government and the Chinese government, having learned the lessons of the earlier U.S. policy decades ago to drive a wedge between the two of them, which was able to be done, even though both of them were at that time ruled by communist parties. China still is. Russia is not. Do you think there would be a recognition that that, in fact, could be a principal strategy of those in the United States, and both sides would recognize a danger therein?
I think both sides do recognize, and I think that's driven their policy over the last period of time. But never underestimate the ability of the United States to offer inducements, because the Russian economy is really suffering, and the U.S. still has more to offer from the point of view of markets and technology than China does. I don't think Putin would retain his electoral base if he turned in that direction. But on the other hand, there's no great love for China in the population in Russia. It's deeply patriotic, and they don't like the U.S. interfering, but they don't want to be told they're reliant on China either. But I agree. I think lessons have been learned from the Sino-Soviet split, and they understand strategically that was very damaging to both.
Well, indeed. That was the voice of Jude Woodward. She's the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War, and she joined us from London. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The European Union is sending a message to Iran. That message is that the Europeans are serious about salvaging the Iran nuclear deal. An aide to the EU's foreign policy chief said yesterday that European firms that stop doing business with Iran will in turn be sanctioned by the EU. We're joined from London by Masoud Shajara. He's the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Masoud, good to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
Masoud, on this show 6 or 8 months ago, we talked about this very issue, and we said that in the event that the Trump administration would pull out of the JCPOA, that the Europeans would likely try to keep the JCPOA in place. That in turn would lead to a confrontation over trade. And it looks like that's where we've found ourselves, where we have a situation now where the U.S. may be forced by its own laws to begin sanctioning its closest friends and allies. How do you see this playing out?
Well, it really is astonishing. I really wasn't expecting that Europeans and indeed China to take such extent, such a stand. I mean, today Germany actually called these sanctions unlawful, and and against international law. I mean, this is really very exciting in many ways. It seems that the international community has recognized that the only way to deal with the bully is to stand up against it. Otherwise, he's going to be bullying people one by one. And indeed, when you look at the behavior of Trump towards China, towards European Union, and indeed elsewhere, he is thinking he could actually bully everybody. And somebody has to stop him. And it seems that now the international community have decided that really nothing good is going to come out of the sort of these maverick policies, which are decided on every tweet by President Trump, and something needs to be done. And indeed, they are making such a stand, which is in many ways very astonishing.
Let's help the audience understand what's actually going on, because what the EU is doing is using its own laws, its own statutes, to prevent or prohibit European companies, EU companies, from withdrawing from business contracts with Iran if they are doing so in compliance with the Trump administration's new sanctions regime against Iran. Here's what I'm going to read to you from a website called Lexology.com, but I think it's a fairly good presentation. Following President Trump's decision to withdraw from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and to reinstate U.S. sanctions against Iran, the European Commission published on June 6, 2018, a proposal for a delegated regulation updating Council Regulation 227196, the so-called blocking statute, to counter the extraterritorial effects of these reinstated sanctions. In the absence of any objection from the European Parliament and the Council of the European Union Commission, delegated regulation, it's been adopted and entered into force on August 7, 2018, that would be yesterday, at the same time the first batch of U.S. sanctions are reinstated. Masoud, let's just unpack that. What is the blocking statute? Try to break it out for the public, for the lay audience. What is the European Union actually trying to do here, and what does this mean?
Well, the European Union are taking the position that this is unlawful, which is indeed it is. The sort of the signing was done not just unilaterally by United States. It was done collectively with the 5+1, and then it was endorsed by the United Nations. And indeed, the mechanism which was there to sort of overlook the whole thing was the International Energy. And the fact is this, that there is really no justification for pulling out of this deal. And so therefore, what the EU is doing is actually protecting its own companies and going further than that, saying that not only the European companies could continue dealing with Iran, but they must. And if indeed they fail, they would take action against their own companies who are pulling out of deals with Iran. This is actually the strongest position that they could have actually shown. And as I said, you know, at the same time, Germany actually called these sanctions unlawful and against international law. In the same time, we have had a statement from China saying that they will continue buying oil from Iran, and they're not going to abide by these sanctions. India has increased its buying oil from Iran, actually. And the reality is that these U.S. sanctions, which are obviously being seen as bully, is actually in disarray because nobody wants to implement them. And the whole of the international community, which, you know, is European Union, China, India, and Russia, are really just turning around to U.S. and saying, we are not going to play ball. And we are not only that, we're actually going to force our companies to continue doing deal with Iran because we see it as something beneficial economically. But also on top of that, what they're saying very clearly and articulating it very clearly is that this is the best deal for the peace and tranquility in the Middle East.
I think what I would be most interested in is sitting in on a meeting at the White House or at the office of the U.S. Trade Representative just to hear how far they're willing to push our friends and allies in Europe. Because it's one thing to talk a tough game to the U.S. media and to say that we are going to stand up and we're going to, you know, put these sanctions on our European allies. It's an entirely different thing to essentially wage a trade war against your closest partners. And I think another thing, too, is that the Trump administration, at least the Office of the Trade Representative, probably didn't believe that the Europeans were going to remain so firm on this and probably thought they would finally acquiesce. Because if they are forced to choose between Iran and the United States, of course, logically, they would choose the United States. And they haven't. They've chosen their own interests, which you would expect any country to do, their own trade interests. And it shows that they believe in the JCPOA.
You know, also, and Masoud, I want you to also comment on this, the whole issue of extraterritoriality, which is what the blocking statute's based on. Extraterritoriality means that the United States, under the Trump administration, and it's done this almost through with every administration on one issue or another, arrogates itself to impose its laws or to be immunized from the laws of another sovereign, another country, a country with sovereignty. And so here the EU is using the issue of extraterritoriality to show if you go along with extraterritoriality, which means to block or inhibit or obstruct or subvert the local laws of the sovereign, the independent country, then you're in violation of this EU statute, and thus you will be punished. Talk about that.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the reality is that, you know, there is no territorial sort of right for the United States to force its own laws and enforce it everywhere around the world. You know, there is no international agreement on this, unlike sometimes when there are sanctions, and those sanctions are endorsed by the United Nations, then they will have some sort of international, not just integrity, but international law is backing it. Here, United States and unilaterally, they are going to force their law on the territories of other countries, including EU and elsewhere. And I think on top of everything else, you know, the calculation has been that United States is so powerful economically that no one will be daring to actually stand up against it. Because doing a deal with the United States, as you said, is more profitable than doing the deals with Iran. But I think, you know, Trump administration is sort of miscalculating, because they're not just dealing with the issue of sanctions with Iran. At the same time, they're starting a war with China, economical war with China, economical war with EU. They are sort of putting tariffs on Chinese, they put in tariffs with the EU, and they're bullying the whole of the international community. So the calculation by the international community, EU and everyone else, is that we can't really allow United States to get away with all this at the same time. And then when, especially with a president, which is so unpredictable and so bullying and so you're changing his mind every 2 seconds between every tweet. That cannot be tolerated.
That's what we have to see play out. That's really the dangerous part of this whole policy. We have to leave it there. We were joined by Masoud Shajara. He's the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
National Security Advisor John Bolton said yesterday that the administration is, quote, still waiting, unquote, for North Korea to begin the denuclearization process. He added that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wants a second summit with President Trump, but that is unlikely absent real progress on the North Korean weapons and nuclear programs. We're joined from New Zealand by author and professor Tim Beal. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. Professor, welcome back.
Good to be back.
So John Bolton made these statements yesterday, and it seemed to be a planned statement in that he was trying to get the media and probably congressional leaders to not expect too much progress in the coming weeks, perhaps the coming months. Is that how you see this?
No, I think, Bolton wants to derail any negotiations, whether it's with Korea or Iran or whatever. That's his two special bit noir. So he's not really warning them about lack of progress. He's saying, you can't trust these foreigners and there will be no progress because of that. Now, of course, his interpretation is very challengeable, but I mean, that's what he's up to. I think he wants to derail the negotiations.
There was a piece in the South Korean press today. It was an interview with the new U.S. ambassador to South Korea, Harry Harris, former very senior military officer. And he said something that I think was important. He said, one of the things that hasn't happened is the demonstrable moves toward denuclearization before we can entertain something like the end of war declaration. I think for the denuclearization to happen, we need to see the move, and I haven't seen that yet. Is that part of a coordinated effort with Bolton to throw a wrench into this?
I mean, yes, they are sort of, in the sense of the same tent, pissing in the same direction. But I think they come at it from different angles. Bolton, I think, wants to destroy negotiations. Harris, don't forget, was a former admiral. His focus is on China. And that's the other big I mean, that's really the basis of American policy of towards Korea is really the containment of China, as it was before the containment of the Soviet Union. So I think that's where Harris is coming from. He's saying somewhat the same things as Bolton, but he's saying for rather different reasons.
So Tim Beal is suggesting that John Bolton is a wrecking ball, period,
wanting to
destroy any sort of even a truce or a treaty or any sort of normalization with America's targeted adversary, so to speak, where Admiral Harris, the new ambassador from the Trump administration to South Korea, actually has a geostrategic thought regarding how to use these negotiations to, quote, contain China. What does that actually look like, though, Tim Beal? What do you mean by that? Are you suggesting, for instance, that the U.S. would hope to, say, pull the DPRK away from China or something like that?
Well, that would be a long-term dream, of course. I mean, and they could, in fact, attempt to do that, but I don't really think there's enough sort of flexibility and cleverness within the U.S. elite to do that. No, I think Harris wants, and in a sense matches behind him, the military, their objective is basically, in a sense, to keep the status quo. They want to retain their U.S. presence in South Korea, in Japan, and so forth, all those bases throughout the Pacific. So anything which imperils them, any sort of breakout of peace, they are against. So I think that's where he's coming from. He's got anything more constructive to say is another matter.
I'm wondering also if there really is a U.S. policy toward North Korea, or if you have the president winging it on the one hand, and then his closest advisors trying to kill whatever progress he might make on the other hand.
Well, some of his advisors. What Tim Beal is suggesting is that there's a difference between Mattis and Bolton here.
Yes, that's right.
Let's call Bolton the wrecking ball, and Mattis.
And then
go ahead.
Yeah, and then there's Pompeo, of course. So, I mean, I think you can perhaps, you know, divide them into three, because what Pompeo is up to, we don't really know. But, he's got these presidential aspirations, so we understand. So he has an interest in pulling something off in East Asia, whether that's means some sort of peace with North Korea is quite uncertain. He probably doesn't even know himself. But, you know, again, his motivations are slightly different from the Pentagon, the Mattises and the Harrises and what have you. And then Bolton, and Bolton is sort of is Bolton, isn't he? I mean, he's very much a lone ranger. He wants to, as you say, he's a wrecking ball.
Yeah, John Bolton, wrecking ball. We're joined from New Zealand by author and professor Tim Beal. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. Tim, let's talk about what the North Koreans are actually saying, because, of course, we never hear their voice, not over here at least. North Korean's foreign minister released a statement denouncing unilateral denuclearization. That was 2 days ago, and I'll read a couple sentences from it to you, and then you can respond. Quote, "We believe that a method involving the balanced, simultaneous, step-by-step implementation of all terms in the joint statement," that's the Singapore statement, "preceded mm-hmm. by the establishment of trust is the only realistic means of achieving success." That was the statement of principles and methodology released by the North Korean foreign minister, Ri Yong-ho, for the implementation of the joint statement from the North Korea-U.S. summit on June 12th in Singapore. Go ahead.
That's right. At the Asian ASEAN Regional Forum. Just a quick point. As you say, you would get very little about this in the American press or the Western press generally. And it's very, if you're interested, it's very worthwhile going to the South Korean press, because, you know, that's where you get articles like this, the statements. You won't find this, I think, in Washington Post or New York Times or Fox News or what have you. So what Ri is saying is merely recapitulating of the standard North Korean position, that it's a long-term process, they have to build trust, it has to be simultaneous, action for action. So the Koreans, for instance, are, according to American sources, are dismantling their Sohae satellite and rocket site. What that means, we don't really know, but I mean, they are making these moves, and we can't really see very much from the American side. So the Koreans, of course, are after security. How that would be possibly guaranteed, I've got no idea. But I mean, that's what these negotiations are about. And if it's going to succeed, it has to be done. It's going to take a long time. And it has to be on some sort of basis of reciprocity and building of trust. And so I think Minister Ri's statement is well worth pondering.
Let's, in our last 2 minutes, talk about the role of Russia and China here. I mean, here you have the situation where the United States sanctions Russia and then insists Russia join it in sanctioning North Korea. The United States declares a trade war against China and then insists that the Chinese leadership join the United States in putting draconian economic sanctions on its neighbor and principal ally, North Korea. In the past, Russia and China have gone along with this. I mean, these are Security Council resolutions. Perhaps they were trying to, I don't know, appease the beast or not want to poke the bear or whatever sort of euphemism we want to use. But where does it go from here?
What they're going to do is going to backpedal even more on implementing sanctions, I think. They won't stand up directly at this stage to the United States. Sometime, perhaps they will have to. But so you see all these things come together, Iran, Korea, the sanctions against Russia, the trade war with China, they all fit into a general pattern and each reinforces each other. So you can't look at them in isolation. So at the moment, they're both very anxious not to to prod the American eagle. But on the other hand, in a sense, they've got no choice. They have to fight back in some way. In respect of North Korea, the simple thing is to ease up on the implementation of sanctions. They won't actually denounce the sanctions, but they won't implement them very strongly either.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, the UN Security Council has the force of law, and those economic sanctions are tough, really tough on North Korea. They've done a lot of damage. But of course, China and Russia, John, they share a border with North Korea. China's is a bigger border. Russia's smaller. But if they want to let that border become porous, they certainly can.
Well, we're out of time. We were joined from New Zealand by author and Professor Tim Beal. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, at iHeartRadio, and now at Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.